If you would, take your Bibles and turn to the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea. Think of this like a sword drill. It's probably not a book of the Bible you open to very often. The book of Hosea. It's before you get to Matthew. It's the end of the Old Testament. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea. We're starting into a more specific approach to the minor prophets today. And we're starting with the first one that's we come to in our Bible, the book of Hosea. And just as an aside, I don't think I mentioned this last week, but when we call these prophets minor prophets, that is not a condescending thing. I like baseball. And in baseball, you have the major leagues and you have the minor leagues. And the people in the minor leagues, they don't get paid very much. They don't have thousands and thousands and thousands of people coming to their games and buying their jerseys and all of those things. So they are a lesser player, so to speak. They're not as valuable to their franchise. They're not as valuable to their fan bases because most of the time people don't know who they are. Whereas in the major leagues, people know their names, people know their stats, and people get their baseball cards and wear their jerseys, and they're well known and well paid. But when we consider the minor prophets, they're not secondary. They're just simply, they have shorter messages as recorded in Scripture. You know, if you look at the book of Isaiah, you look at the book of Jeremiah, they're long messages that God gave to them, over 60 chapters. We get to Hosea, and it's 14 chapters, but they're fairly short chapters in that. And some of the other prophets have even shorter messages that are recorded. So minor does not mean less important or less significant. It simply means that they're shorter. So Hosea being the first, and we're going to be doing a lot of intro things, I suppose, even this morning for the book of Hosea, learning who he is and it's kind of the background and backdrop during which he prophesied, and then we'll also look today at the picture of his life. His life was used as a teaching tool for him, which then also allowed him to be able to more effectively communicate the message that God wanted him to deliver to his people. So Hosea, let's look at verse number 1. Hosea chapter 1, hopefully that gave you enough time to find it. Hosea chapter number 1 says, "The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea the son of Beeri in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel." So this first verse gives us a lot of background into who Hosea was and the time in which he was ministering. There was a handout at the back. I don't know if you got the handout. It's a new one this week, and it's probably simpler to follow. But on that, I have listed the kings that Hosea prophesied during the reigns of. And I broke it down into the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. So we're going to spend a little bit of time just getting a quick summary of who these people were. Uzziah was a good king. He's described as being good or doing that which was right. However, there is a caveat that is placed on his reign. It says that when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. That's probably the biggest downfall of humanity is that when he was strong. And because it's just when we're strong, when things are going well, there's a tendency just within man to say, oh, you know what? I have this under control. I figured something out. I know what I'm doing. I know where I'm going. I can figure out the next step because I've gotten to this point. And that's exactly what happened to Uzziah. When he was strong, then he turned away from the Lord. Some things that the Bible says about him, it says that he had a large army. He had a mighty war machine. He was successful in warfare. It also says that he loved husbandry. He was a farmer. And part of his warfare allowed him to expand his farming operations. He conquered lands and opened that up for his farming. But the big but in his life was that the people sacrificed in high places. So there were, all throughout the kingdoms, there were high places, places where people worshiped the false gods that were in the land before they moved in, which we'll mention some of those names later. But But they still went to those places, and they sacrificed in those places to these false gods. God had established a system that was centered around the temple, which was still in existence at this time and still in use. However, it was not the only place, and people had a tendency to go off to the sidelines and worship in these high places. And then he himself went in and offered incense in the place of the Levites. So that was definitely a big no-no. He, as the king, was not permitted to do that. However, he was strong, and he figured, you know, I've gotten to this point. I can go in. I can do this thing on my own. The consequences will be minimal, if any. I'm going to take matters into my own hand. And when he did that, he was approached by the priests, and they delivered a message to him, and God struck him with leprosy at that moment, and he was a leper until his death. So he was recorded as being a good king. However, there's this asterisk that was associated with his name because of all of these other things that he did. His son then became the king. His name was Jotham. And the Bible says that he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah did. Howbeit, he entered not into the temple of the Lord, so he did not make that same mistake. But then it goes on and says, and the people did yet corruptly. So there was a corruption that persisted through his reign. So the people, they still sacrificed in the high places. He did do some positive things. He built in the city. He built in Jerusalem. But it also then says that the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Syria, and Remaliah's son Pekah against Judah. So there was some developing warfare that was a result of this sacrificing in these high places, these going after, this perpetual going after these other gods, the gods of the people of the land, which brought some judgment against them. And we have foreign armies starting to knock on the door of Judah. We go on, his son then, Ahaz, not to be confused with Ahab, they're very different people. However, it says of Ahaz that he did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord his God, like David his father. So as a reminder, last week we looked at the two kingdoms, and the southern kingdom of Judah, they followed after their father David. And every king was a descendant of David. And it compares them to David, and it will say that they did right like David, or they did not do right like David. So Ahaz was one of the ones that did not do right like David his father. It says of him that he sacrificed in the high places, that he sent his sons through the fire. Now, that was a practice of the pagan people in the land before they moved in, where they would sacrifice even their own children. As I was thinking about this, you know, some of these things kind of stuck out in my mind because our culture, though we probably wouldn't say it in the same terminology, we do a lot of these same things. Say, well, how do we sacrifice in the high places? You think about just kind of how what our culture does and what our culture worships, and what are our culture, let's get these words straightened out, what our culture, what they make their sacrifices to. And there's a lot of people that sacrifice to social media. They give all of their time and they give their devotion, and they are so geared toward following these things. And you know, you deal with teenagers in the school, and you hear them talk about different things. And I'm sure not all of them are evil, but they just give their time to these things. And a lot of times, if we're not careful, even as believers, we can give more time to those things and ignore God. But there's that tendency to sacrifice to things. There's also the giving of our children as a culture. You know, that's kind of in the forefront of the news and of the media today. Just this what do we do with our babies? Do we want our babies? Do we not want our babies? And it's really a repulsive thought that we even have to think about that, and we have to consider it. However, that's the direction of our culture. And so there's some parallels that we could make. We could think about some of these things and say, you know, these people that we read about in the Old Testament, you know, look how bad they were, look how wicked they are. However, we need to be careful that we don't allow ourselves to distance ourselves so far from that to think that we're not susceptible to the same things. So he sacrificed in the high places. He sent his sons through the fire. Syria and Israel, the northern tribes, came against him, and he went to Assyria to bail him out. We read about that in 2 Kings. He paid Assyria to come alongside him and fight against Syria and Israel so that he would not be destroyed. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. So though he was a king in the kingdom of Judah, he was like one of the kings of Israel. And as we'll mention in just a minute, all of the kings of Israel were evil. It does not say, God does not praise any of the kings of Israel like he did some of the kings of Judah. He also made molten images for Baalim. You know, that's an obvious breach against God, right? He's making things, he's making images of false gods. And why is he making them? Because he thought they would do something for him. He thought they would help him. And that's, we'll see through the book of Hosea how that exact thing was a problem throughout the kingdom. That was the reason for their problems, and they had a tendency to keep going back to those things, thinking they were going to help them, but in reality, those were the things that were harming them the most. The last king during the reign of Hosea in the southern kingdom of Judah was Hezekiah, and there's a lot that we could say about him. We're just going to sum it up here. It does say that he did right in the sight of the Lord. He opened and repaired the doors of the house of the Lord. He's the sort of the famous king because Isaiah came to Hezekiah and told him to get his house in order. He was going to die. He turned back to God, and God granted his request to heal him, and his life was extended for 15 years. So it's a pretty significant king of Judah. However, Hosea really just overlapped the beginning of his reign, so we're not going to go too deeply into King Hezekiah. Now let's transition to the northern kingdom of Israel. The king that was on the throne when Hosea began to rule was Jeroboam II. And he basically patterned his kingdom after Jeroboam I. Now last week we talked about the split of the kingdoms. And Jeroboam I was the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel. And the thing that he did that was so repulsive to God and that became the measuring stick of evil for the kings of the north is that he made golden calves and set them up in the land to be their god. He said, I don't know what it is about these cows, but it seems to be the thing that the Israelites wanted to do. Remember, it's Mount Sinai. When Moses was up on the mount, Aaron, what he said, he threw the gold into the fire and out came this calf. And they were worshiping this golden calf, and it was a problem for them. It was a curse to them. And now here, Jeroboam the first, he set up these two golden calves, and part of the reason for him doing it in this case is that he didn't want his subjects leaving his kingdom and going to the kingdom of Judah and going to the temple to make their sacrifices and to worship there, because he was afraid that if they went back there, that they would give their allegiance, maybe they would be revived. And they would give their allegiance back to the king of Judah. So he established this worship that was patterned after the pagans in the land, and it was a stumbling block to the people. But Jeroboam II now, he was a descendant of Jehu. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. After him, his son Zechariah became the king. So Jeroboam, you'll notice he served for a long time. His son Zechariah, a short time, just 6 months. Says of him that he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was assassinated only 6 months, and then he was assassinated by one named Shallum. We get all these details, and we're not going to go into this looking at them, but in 2 Kings 15, 16, 17, we can see all of the details that God gives us about these various kings. So his son, or Zechariah, he was assassinated by Shallum. He was also, it's kind of significant that he made it to the throne because God prophesied that Jehu would have kings for four generations. In his family, kings for four generations. Zechariah was the fourth generation of kings in his family, and then he was assassinated by Shallum. Now here's where it kind of, to me, is a little bit comical. Because of Shallum, it then says that he reigned, and you could look this up in the Bible, it's a direct quote, he reigned a full month. That just seems comical to me, a full month. We're talking about people that reigned for decades, for many years. And then it says of this guy, a full month. It seems to me that he was somebody that God used for a specific purpose. The dynasty of Jehu had to come to a close. God had prophesied it would last for four generations, for there would be four kings in his family on the throne. And then this guy comes up out of seemingly nowhere and assassinates that fourth king in his family line. And he's only on the scene for a month. You know, that just really points to me that God had a purpose for this man, that God used this man to just to fulfill that prophecy, and then he's off the scene. He was then assassinated by Menahem, and that king then reigned for 10 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was a brutal and ruthless warrior. He paid tribute to, losing my microphone here, paid tribute to Assyria to avoid conflict, paid him 1,000 talents of silver. He would then die, and his son Pekahiah would reign for 2 years. He also did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He was assassinated by one of his captains, Pekah, who reigned for 20 years, also did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was assassinated by Hoshea, who reigned 9 years in Israel. He did evil in the sight of the Lord until the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria. So we look at the northern kingdom of Israel, evil after evil after evil after evil. There was just complete upheaval and turmoil within the kings and these assassinations left and right. And you look at that and you say, you know what? They probably were not in the will of God. God was probably trying to get their attention. And that's exactly what was going on. They had done evil as a king, from the king down to the people. And God was trying to get their attention. They rejected God's call, and God would then send judgment upon them. So that's what's going on the throne, both in Judah and Israel, during the time that Hosea was prophesying. Let's continue now and look at Hosea's family. Let's look at verse number 2. Hosea 1, verse 2 says, "The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Dibleam, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said unto him, Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." So here we're introduced to Hosea, his wife, and his first son. Hosea's mean, as I have on the sheet for you, means essentially salvation, or the Lord saves. It's very similar to the names like Joshua, or in the New Testament, a name like Jesus. It was a name that was designed to show them something, to reveal to them, you know what, you have problems. There are very serious issues within the kingdom, within your nation, and your only source of help is God. You know, that's an important place for every believer to get. You know, we have problems, we face difficulties, and our only true source of help is God. You know, how often do we turn to other things? And we see that through these lives of these kings. They turn to other people. They turn to other powers and hope that they would help them. But the only one that could truly save them was God. His wife Gomer, her name means completion. And it says of her that she was that Hosea was to marry a wife of whoredoms. And that Esther at the end seems kind of almost like a typo to us when we read that. However, it's significant. It shows a characterization of her. There's a speculation, we don't know for certain, but there's speculation that she could have been a temple priestess, which is a very wicked practice that was brought in by some of the wicked kings and was patterned after the practices of the pagan people, where they would have these priestesses that would just be there for basically the pleasure of the people. And it was a terrible practice, and perhaps she was taken in to that, and perhaps she was a victim, we could say, of that practice that had come in to Israel. His wife's name, as I mentioned, means Gomer, or it means completion, and the purpose of this was to illustrate the adultery of the people of Israel and turning away from God. And God here equates the nation's idolatry and going to these false gods and leaving the true God, he equates that to adultery. It's something that they could see, that Hosea was having to deal with in his personal life, and it was something very difficult and heavy upon his heart. And it was allowing him to be able to really communicate very effectively to the people. He felt, we could say, what God was feeling as his people were departing from him, as his people were turning to these other gods and seeking after them, Hosea felt that same burden and difficulty, and it allowed him to be able to communicate what needed to be communicated. It allowed him to be able to just deal very clearly with the issue at hand. We saw his first child. His first son's name was Jezreel. And God gave him the names of these children, and they meant something immediately, but some of them also had some long-term prophecies associated with their names. So Jezreel means scatter, or may God scatter. And this was the birth of his son was accompanied by the pronouncement of judgment by God against the northern kingdom of Israel. Notice it says there in the middle of verse 4, "For yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu." Jezreel is an interesting place. We could probably spend an entire class just studying that place and all the things that happened. We could go back even to Ahab and Jezebel. And Ahab, when he was the king of Israel, he really wanted somebody else's property. He wanted Naboth's property, and it was right there. It was a convenient place for him. So he asked Naboth for it. He asked to purchase it, and Naboth said, "No, I can't do it. God gave me this as my inheritance. I can't sell it to you. That would not be right for me to do because God gave this to me." So then Jezebel, his wife, also very wicked, ended up murdering him and taking that property from Naboth, who was described as Naboth the Jezreelite. So we have that connection there between now we have Hosea's son Jezreel, the promise of judgment coming up in this place. Go back to Ahab, who had, through his wife, had Naboth the Jezreelite murdered. It would be the place where Ahab and Jezebel would be killed. And now Jehu, in his dynasty, if we could say, those four kings, they also did wickedly, and their judgment would come at that same place. And there's future implications here as well. So it's this name of his son had a lot of significance, and it means scatter. And that's exactly what God would do with this place. There would be much disruption. The people would be scattered. You consider what happened after the end of Jehu's dynasty, which is those list of kings we went through in the southern kingdom. Shalom and Menahem and Pekahiah and Pekah and Hosea. All of these people, all of these kings, a very rapid succession because they were doing evil. And it resulted in Israel being scattered. They were taken out of the land and deported to other places. So first son, Jezreel. The second child, look at verse number 6. Hosea 1:6, "And she conceived again and bare a daughter, and God said unto him, Call her name Loruhamah, for I will have no mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen." So a second child, Loruhamah. This is something that certainly I don't think anyone would name their child if they had the choice. Even if you were given two choices, you probably would avoid this one because it means basically not pitied, that this child not obtained mercy. There's speculation. Remember who Gomer was in her past. There's speculation that this was not actually a biological daughter of Hosea. We don't know that for sure, but there's speculation in regards to that. We think about the name Loruhamah, not pitied or having not obtained pity. You kind of could see where that could come from. However, we also see the prophecy in regards to the northern kingdom of Israel, that God would not have pity on them because of their continual violation of God's law, their continual running to idolatry, their continual refusal of God's plea for them to turn back. They would not find mercy. They would not find the pity of God. It's interesting here. It's Hosea's ministry primarily is to the northern kingdom of Israel. However, there is a just kind of a little aside in here given to the kingdom of Judah. And if you recall, the kingdom of Judah had some good kings, and that allowed God to bless them and show pity on them. And it says here that though though the northern kingdom, the house of Israel, would be taken away, that God would have mercy on Judah, and that God would save them, not by their power, but by his power alone. Hold your place here. Let's turn to 2 Kings chapter 19. We see here how God would answer this request, how God would step in for them. 2 Kings 19, we're not going to spend a lot of time here reading all of the problems that we face here, but let's just look, let's kind of see, we'll get the tone of the chapter here. Let's look at verse number 8. It says, "So Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he was departed from Lachish. And when he heard say of Tirhakah, king of Ethiopia, behold, he has come out to fight against thee, he sent messengers again unto Hezekiah, saying, Thus shall you speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, Let not thy God, in whom thou trustest, deceive thee, saying, Jerusalem shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, thou hast heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by destroying them utterly. And shalt thou be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered them, which my fathers have destroyed, as Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the king of Eden, which were in Thelesar? Where is the king of Hamath and the king of Arpad and the king of the city of Sepharvaim of Hena and Iva?" So we have Assyria threatening Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a good king, just overall a good king of Judah. So there's threatenings coming from a very powerful and very successful military nation. Threatenings coming down to Hezekiah. If you were to continue, we see how Hezekiah sought the face of God, how Hezekiah went to God. If you were just to read some of those verses, let's just read one verse, verse 16. It says, "Lord, bow down thine ear and hear. Open, Lord, thine eyes and see, and hear the words of Sennacherib, which has sent him to reproach the living God." We see the humility of Hezekiah in that verse. You know, he was going to God. He realized that he didn't have the power to be victorious in this fight. But he went to God very humbly and asked for God's help to defend God's name. And down to verse number 35 in the same chapter, we see how God did give this deliverance, not by Hezekiah's might, not by his warriors, not by his horses and his horsemen. 2 Kings 19:35 says, "And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses." So in one night, the angel of the Lord steps up, stands up for Judah, and wipes out 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. God did that for them. It was to show his might, to show his power. And as we read what Hezekiah prayed, this was, "God, you defend your name. You show yourself strong to us." And he did that. So we see that prophecy that was given in Hosea was fulfilled here through God delivering them, not by their own might, but definitely and obviously by the hand of God. So back to Hosea, we see first on Jezreel, that pronouncement really against Jehu's family, that was accomplished. Then Loruhamah, a prophecy against Israel that they would be scattered. Yet though they would be scattered, Judah would be spared, that God would deliver them. Get down to verse number 8. It says, "Now when she had weaned Loruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, Call his name Lo-Ami, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God." So his next child, his third child, second son, his name essentially means "not my people." And there's also implication that Hezekiah was not the father. You could see the connection there between that name, but also the name carried with it significance to Israel. That they would not be his people, they would not follow God. And the result of that is essentially they would get what they were pursuing. They would get what they were pursuing in that when they decided that God was not going to be their God, God said, "I'll not be your God," and allowed judgment to come upon them. So the birth of this child, God illustrates how those who were to be called by his name had become estranged from him. So we see that order, "Ye are not my people, I will not be your God." Now, that's a pretty low place to get to from a people that were called out of the world. They were given the name of God upon them. They were given his blessing for a time. They were given his promise. And then to get to this point where God would call down and says, look, you're not my people, and I will not be your God. If it ended there, that would be very dark. However, notice how this first chapter ends. Yet, verse number 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Now, this is really an incredible turning point just in this prophecy, because there's bad news after bad news after bad news for Israel. However, we see really a glorious truth about our God is that he doesn't give up on us. You know, he offers us, even today, second chances. You know, how many of us could say, you know, I've messed up. I knew God wanted me to do something, and I just didn't do it. Maybe I forgot. Maybe I intentionally went against God, but God was still there. When we turn back to God, we'll find that he's there. And that's what we see here through this this message that was given through Hosea. We see the connection to that promise that God made to Abraham and that covenant that he made with them, that they would be basically innumerable, that they would be as the sand of the sea. Even though trouble was coming, the promises of God were still true. The promises of God could still be counted on. Same today, right? We can still count on the promises of God. We can look at what he says to us. We can read his word. We can learn about who he is and know that those same things can apply to us today. He's still the same God. They will again be called the sons of the living God. Think about how comforting that would be after hearing God say, I will not be your God. And then hearing him say, there will be a day when you'll be called the sons of the living God. You know, how and powerful that would have been to them, you would think. And how much motivation, when they saw this judgment come, there should have been for them to turn back to God and say, look, God told us this was coming. We persisted, but look what God promised us. Look what God has offered to us. One of the really powerful things about God is just his ability to restore. You know, think about that. God has the ability to restore beyond any of our capabilities. You know, sometimes you might have something that's really old, and maybe you want to restore it. Maybe you want somebody to restore it professionally. And there you could have something really old and maybe valuable, and someone could look at it and say, you know what, this is not going to be that hard to restore. We can polish it up a little bit, maybe just replace this part here, and it'll be like new. We can call this a restored item. And people can do that. There's people that have professions just surrounded around that idea, around that topic. However, there are times when you might have that thing that is really old, but it's been in the basement too long, and it's gotten wet too many times, and it's deteriorated to the point that you bring it to the restorer, and the restorer says, it's too far gone. There's nothing we can do. The best we can do is keep it from getting any worse. But God is the master restorer. You know, he doesn't look at a broken life and say, you know what, there's nothing we can do to redeem this. There's nothing we can do to fix this. The best that we can do is just kind of hide it off in the corner and maybe put something in front of it so you don't see the flaws. And you know what? God can do a tremendous work of restoration in the life of anybody. And God can still use anybody, no matter how far down they've gone, because he's the master restorer. That's a tremendous truth that we see through the book of Hosea. Why? Because in this book, we find repeatedly Israel turning from God. We find repeatedly them going away from God and pursuing false gods, pursuing these idols of the land, and just running to their own destruction and doing so willfully. Yet at the same time, we see how God is there with open arms and ready to restore and able to restore. What a tremendous blessing that is for us to consider about our God, about who he is. He prophesies here that the kingdoms will be reunited. They'll be united under one head. And a lot of this pointing to the reign of Jesus Christ, and how he will set up his kingdom and restore and call together Israel and be their king have a united kingdom again, no more division. It points to that. But we see this idea of this restoration, and that's all throughout this book, all throughout Hosea's prophecy. We see God calling his people. We'll kind of get ahead of ourselves here. Let's go to the last chapter of Hosea, Hosea 14. I guess we'll fill in the middle chapters here next week. But Hosea 14, let's just consider this idea of this restoration of God. Hosea 14, verse 1 says, O Israel, return unto the Lord thy God, for thou hast fallen by thine iniquity. Take with you words, and turn to the Lord, and say unto him, Take away all iniquity, and receive us graciously. So will we render the calves of our lips. Asher shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses. Neither will we say any more to the work of our hands, Ye are our gods, for in thee the fatherless findeth mercy. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily, and cast forth his roots as Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon. They that dwell under the shadow shall return. They shall revive as the corn, and grow as the vine. The scent thereof shall be as the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, Oh, what have I to do any more with idols? I have heard him and observed him. I am like a green fir tree. From me is thy fruit found. Who is wise, and he shall understand these things? Prudent, and he shall know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them. But the transgressors shall fall therein. And we have, from beginning to end, this promise of God being there, being ready to restore, being ready to heal. And that's a truth that does not stop with Hosea. It does not stop with the Old Testament. It continues to this day. When we fall, when we turn away from God, we can turn back to him, and God can restore us. Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day.